from SDPB Radio. I'm Chris Loffrey, and you are listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Death row inmate Charles Rhines has been battling execution since he was sentenced to death by a Pennington County jury in 1993. Now, it appears his battle is ending. A warrant of execution has been issued for the first week of November. Two of his appeals were dismissed last Friday, one in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals and the other in the South Dakota Supreme Court. Monday on In the Moment, we focused on Charles Rhines, his appeals, and death penalty considerations, both specific and general. SDPB's Kara Hetland talked with SDPB's Victoria Wicks.
Charles Rhines finally has an execution date, and that comes after about 26 years of appeals for his 1993 conviction.
Yes, it has been a long time coming. His first appeal to South Dakota Supreme Court was argued October 18, 1995, with an opinion issued the following May. I read through that opinion and recognized names from my time with Pennington County Victims Assistance in the late 80s. One of them was Steve Allender, who was a detective who questioned Charles Rhines and took his confession. Steve later became chief of police and now is mayor of Rapid City. The judge was John Konenkamp, who was presiding judge in the Seventh Circuit back then and now a retired South Dakota Supreme Court justice.
So what were some of the issues that Rhines brought up in his first appeal?
He said he hadn't been thoroughly advised of his rights to remain silent and have an attorney, and he wanted his confession thrown out. He also objected to the dismissal of one of the prospective jurors who said she didn't think she could vote for death. Rhines also thought the judge should be able to disregard a jury's decision to put the offender to death and instead give a sentence of life without parole. And he objected to jurors hearing about a conversation he had with Steve Allender and Pennington County Deputy Sheriff Don Barr when those two investigators went to King County in Washington State to interview Rhines after he was taken into custody there and identified as a suspect in Schaefer's murder. Rhines told the Rapid City detectives if he had $100,000, he could drop it for a fancy attorney, his words, and walk free. He thought the jury might have been prejudiced to hear that he thought justice would be applied unevenly and that he would be punished only because he couldn't afford to be acquitted.
And this was after he confessed to the murder?
Yes, and that was a very strong confession. In a transcript of the interrogation, Rhines is quoted as telling the detectives, "I don't deserve anything but a kick in the teeth and the electric chair." In that first appeal, Rhines wanted a community attitude assessment done because he was afraid his homosexuality would prejudice the jury, but that was denied. During the trial, while deliberating, the jury sent out a question for the judge and asked if Rhines would be able to describe or brag about his crime to other inmates, if he would be allowed to marry or have conjugal visits, and if he would be alone or have a cellmate. The judge acknowledged he received the questions and sent back the reply that all the information he could provide was set forth in jury instructions.
And wasn't the allegation of gay prejudice part of a more recent appeal?
Yeah, it was, but I never heard about that aspect of the case until recently. I didn't start covering this case until around 2005, and I'd already left Victims Assistance in Pennington County when the crime occurred.
I suppose there's a pretty long list of all the appeals and hearings since 1993.
Yes, and I'm not going to try to summarize them. They include a court trial involving state drug protocols that they violated due process, and the Eighth Amendment prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment. He's challenged procedures of the court, the prison, and the state, and has sought relief from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals more than once, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, I've covered every recent execution in South Dakota, not as a journalist witness, but in the reporter's pool. It's not an easy thing to do, is it?
It is hard to cover these cases. You know, we have to be objective, not that we have to find something positive to say about the crime or the offender, but we do have to stick to facts and not insert our opinions. But when we hear details of the case, Donald Moeller raped and then killed a 9-year-old girl who had gone to a convenience store in her neighborhood, and her naked body was left in a field. She'd been stabbed, her throat was slashed. It's just too much to bear to try to imagine her final hour. There's a picture of her online, one of those typical school pictures with a pink clip in her hair and a pink turtleneck and that hesitant smile. She died in 1990, so she'd be 38 years old now if Moeller hadn't killed her. But you can also find details of Moeller's childhood online, and it's a grim story. He started drinking when he was 8, and he'd been sexually assaulted at a young age. So maybe telling that in news coverage contributes to balance.
Well, these death penalty trials have such heightened importance. And of course, that is the defendants might eventually be executed. But there's something else, though, that sets them apart.
I've watched a lot of trials, and I've heard defense attorneys tell jurors over and over again that the state has the burden of proving that the crime happened and the right person is being prosecuted for it. So the jury essentially evaluates the state's performance to determine if the prosecution has met its burden of proving all the elements of the crime. When the jury finds somebody guilty, they're making that determination in the eyes of the law. They're not judging if the defendant is a good person or a bad person. But with a death penalty case, after the jury has found the defendant guilty, they then move on to the sentencing phase, and that process is much more subjective. They're essentially deciding if the defendant deserves to live. And that's a big obligation.
Young adults in juvenile corrections are learning to train and care for animals. The Humane Society of the Black Hills bring in critters from geckos to puppies to give detainees some hands-on experience. SDPB's China Lockett reports.
A litter of bright-eyed, chubby husky puppies are being bathed in neon kiddie pools. Some whine as smiling young men in green uniforms lather them in soap, then pass them off to peers for a towel dry.
Come back.
Employees from the Humane Society of the Black Hills stop by once a week with different animals. They teach state, federal, and international detainees at Western South Dakota Juvenile Services Center tricks of the trade.
Why do we socialize puppies?
So they can learn.
Learn what?
How to act.
Yep, they have to learn what's appropriate and what's not. How to play, they need to get corrected.
After the baths, detainees play tug of war and throw squeaky toys for the puppies.
No, that's cheating.
One young adult grins as he cradles a mass of fur like a baby in his arms. He says it's the first time he's held a husky. We aren't using the young man's name for privacy.
They're kind of cool. They're pretty huge. They're fluffy and they shed a lot, but they're good dogs though. They can outstand their coat because they got two layers of coats. They're good for sledding and stuff like that.
Before the puppies are taken back to the Humane Society for adoption, the young men are asked to name each one.
That's Ruby and this Max.
Ruby and Max.
They got to get adopted together though.
Joe Gutierrez is the commander of the Juvenile Services Center. He says this is an incentive-based program for kids with good behavior.
By working with the animals, they learn responsibility. And they learn trust and also empathy because these dogs are going to be adopted and they don't have owners right now. And some of our kids, you know, are going through some struggles as well. And, you know, they're hoping that someone takes a chance on them too as well when they leave.
The South Dakota Democratic Party will elect a new chair in early December. Whitney Raver has officially announced her run for South Dakota's lone seat in the U.S. House. Dakota Political Junkie's John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, and Jonathan Ellis, investigative reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, made up this week's Political Junkies panel.
All right, let's talk more about the Democrats because I think we've documented their financial woes pretty well in this program and other news publications across the state. And now they are trying to make a way forward. Jonathan, kind of kick us off a little bit with what's ahead for the party in the coming months.
Well, I mean, they need to find some leadership. You know, they have... their chairwoman stepped down, Paula Hawks. Their executive director stepped down. I mean, they've only been in these positions in, you know, in a matter of you know, a couple of months for with regard to the executive director, Stacey Burnett. She'd just been on the job since August, and Paula Hawks had been elected back in March, and she'd vowed to kind of, you know, set a new direction for the party, and that has, you know, has not happened. And so, you know, you look at Randy Seiler, who I think was reluctantly took on the vice chairmanship. Now suddenly he finds himself as the chair. He doesn't want to be the chair. And so they have to find a way forward in terms of electing, finding new leadership who can, you know, A, deal with the financial issues that the party has, and B, kind of find a way to reach out to voters and make themselves relevant to voters in elections going forward here.
Let's talk a little bit about the response from the state Republican Party as well, John Hunter, because Dan Lederman, the party chair, issued a statement saying that the Democrats were bankrupt financially and in the arena of ideas. How is the Republican Party sort of capitalizing on this right now? And when do you go too far? Is there a too far in this, or is it time to sort of sink the dagger in, John?
Yeah, boy, it's kind of unprecedented that I'm aware of, at least, where you have political party in South Dakota be at such kind of lows, again, lacking of leadership, no statewide offices, a very small number of legislators, and how that goes. But I think we've spoken before that Republicans would love to kind of keep gaining strength. On the other hand, the success doesn't seem to keep people still, so you tend to have kind of now almost a two-party system within the Republicans. So you've got the kind of the far-right Republicans and then the more moderate Republicans. So in some senses, there's almost two parties within the GOP. So, but I think of, how can they pull themselves up by their bootstraps when they don't have money, don't have people, don't have, all the things. They do have a lot of, 150,000 registered Democrats in South Dakota there. So it's not like it's gone to zero. But I think really I would think that the national party would be interested in helping some way. I know they made a small financial contribution just to kind of get through the month or two or whatever it was. But I think the National Democratic Party, which does have a lot of strength, then would want a strong organization in every state. So I think that might be where they would look next.
And what needs to happen for that, the next leadership, the person who's going to be able to convince people to write those checks, because something good will happen with the money, that it won't be wasted.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned last week, I think it would take an evangelist of some sort, someone who's passionate about it, someone who has time to do it, or the wherewithal to do that. Chairperson is not a full-time paid position. The executive director is, and that's where you need to find someone who's going to put a lot of miles on the car and rally county committees and do all the things. And boy, it would take a lot of time and a lot of energy to do that.
Yeah. So Seth Tupper wrote a column in the Rapid City Journal, which I thought was really insightful, because he also points out how close some of these elections in South Dakota have been. It's maybe a little premature to write this party off. I think Jonathan Ellis, Dan Lederman says, hey, Democrats, come on over to the Republican side and let's work together. Corey Heidelberger has written in his blog about, maybe it's time, maybe this is the death rattle. And Seth Tupper is saying, well, this might be premature because some of those races, including our recent race for governor, were way closer than one would think with the state of this Democratic Party. What are your thoughts, Jonathan Ellis?
Yeah, I thought, Seth has definitely some interesting insights. I thinking that if Daschle had won in 2004 and Stephanie Herseth Sandlin had been able to retain her seat in 2010, that things would be a lot different, and that if Senator Tim Johnson had not had his health issues. I look at it, and I think that there have been some demographic shifts in South Dakota and across the country, frankly. I mean, I think that we've become much more inclined, or less inclined, I should say, to vote for, if you're a Republican, to vote for a Democrat, and a Democrat to vote for a Republican. I think we've become more polarized. And that's South Dakota, but that's a reflection of the country as a whole. And so I think that those demographic shifts sort of portended these eventual defeats for the Democrats. And so maybe I'm a little more pessimistic about their future than Seth is.
I just think that there have been some shifts ideologically that favor Republicans in certain portions of the country, including South Dakota, and they favor Democrats in other parts of the country.
All right, so let's talk about some candidates. We have a new Democratic candidate, Whitney Raver, who wants to head to Congress, challenge U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson. What do we know about Whitney, and does she fit any of those? Can you check off any of those boxes with her as far as who South Dakotans tend to want to send to Washington? Jonathan Ellis, a little bit about Whitney.
Well, I mean, you know, as John said, she's young, so she checks that box. She's 32. She's West River. I mean, I think we're going to learn more about her in the campaign, but from what I have heard about her and what I've read, you know, she's somebody who kind of had a hard scrabble life growing up. She, you know, grew up in poverty and has kind of a compelling life message about pulling herself up and, you know, she kept fighting, I guess, and, you know, and wanting to do better for, in her life. That's kind of a compelling message that I think that would appeal to a lot of people. And so we'll learn more about her and her life, West River. But, you know, from what I've heard about her now recently, I mean, I think she's got a very, very compelling message.
And John Hunter, is it possible, you know, when the party itself and really all the news about the Democrats that's dominating, you know, our conversations and so many others is about what kind of trouble they're in. Does a candidate like Whitney Raver have a chance to gain ground when her party, you know, she's not standing on a stable foundation?
I do, but I'm going to toss one other thing in that mix, too. I don't think the party, you know, finances or leadership would have a role in there. But there is incredible power to the incumbency in South Dakota. And so once you're in Congress, your ability to hold onto that seat is very strong. That is the battle that she has to face. I don't think it's the fact that the party, the state party apparatus isn't in as healthy a shape as it'd like. I, like Jonathan, would love to hear more about Whitney during the course of this election. I think some South Dakotans, certainly a lot of people nationally, would like to see non-politicians go to Congress, people with different experiences, and she has some of those experiences, and I think her announcement kind of indicated that she would have more compassion for poverty and economics and those sorts of things. So I am really eager to hear her campaign and see if she's the candidate that South Dakotans want.
What does Dusty Johnson have to do then with such a short turnaround time? Is he vulnerable because of the time that he went to Congress or because of sort of his stance once he went there?
Well, I mean, he's vulnerable in some senses because of a primary challenge. I mean, that's probably where I would say that, you know, his first concern would be as a primary challenge. And then, you know, if you can fight and survive a nasty primary challenge, that can you know, oftentimes set you up for failure in a general election. I mean, we saw that in 1986 with Jim Abner and Bill Janklow. They had a nasty primary, and that led to, you know, in some senses led to Abner's defeat against Tom Daschle in 86. And so we saw the same thing more recently between Marty Jackley and Kristi Noem. It was a tough primary, and as we noted earlier in the program, you know, Billy Sutton got pretty close to defeating Noem. So, you know, his first challenge, I think, is to ward off a primary challenge, and that's, you know, he does have, you know, he came into office sort of with a controversial vote, you know, opposing President Trump's, you know, he wanted an emergency declaration at the border, and Dusty opposed that, and so I think that immediately kind of put him in the crosshairs of some of the pro-Trump people here, and so that's going to be his biggest issue. The first challenge that he will have is to see whether he gets a primary challenge. We're going to know that soon. I mean, winter's creeping up on us here, and that means the primary season's right around the corner.
This past weekend, the leader of ISIS was located and targeted in a U.S. Special Forces raid. What changes for ISIS? How does al-Baghdadi's death affect the region? Tim Shorn, Director of International Studies and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota, visited with SDPB's Jackie Hendry.
bring us a little bit up to speed. Who was Abubakar al-Baghdadi, and what does it mean that he is now dead?
Mr. Baghdadi was one of a number of people from Iraq, Syria, and the larger Middle East who had originally joined al-Qaeda, but eventually decided that al-Qaeda was too measured in its activities and too limited in its goals, and they broke off and created what became known as the Islamic State. One of the major goals of the Islamic State, and therefore Baghdadi, was to create a new caliphate, a new Islamic state. And so he ordained himself, if you will, as caliph, something that hadn't been around since the 1920s. And he decided that he and his followers could create an Islamic state in parts of Syria, about half of Syria and about a third of Iraq at its height, about the size of the United Kingdom. Hmm. And what they created was something that was going to be rooted in a very, very conservative, even extreme form of Islam that looked back on, they would call it the golden days of Islam, probably the first couple of generations of Islam after the Prophet Muhammad. And they wanted to create a state based on that. And to a great extent, they did. Eventually, they lost their territory. They maintained their fighters. And clearly, Baghdadi was somebody who was going to be targeted by the United States and others in an attempt to kind of cut the head off the snake. Baghdadi was interesting in that he truly had religious credentials. Unlike anyone in al-Qaeda who were essentially kind of pretenders, Baghdadi had a doctorate in Islamic theology. It was clear that he was very much an extremist, but he had the religious credentials, the vision, and the desire to move forward. And as of Sunday, he is no more.
And what does the future of the Islamic State, or ISIS, as we often refer to it, what does that look like now that he is gone? Is there a new leader that has been named, or what are we expecting now?
There have been two or three people who have been floated as potential successors. One was Baghdadi's and ISIS's spokesman, Abu Hassan al-Muhajir. He was the spokesperson. It appears that he has been killed also. Mm. But probably the person who is most likely to become the successor to Baghdadi is Alhaj Abdullah Kardash. He is a Turkmen Iraqi, which can cause some problems because many people in ISIS are going to want somebody who is Arab and who can trace their lineage back to the Prophet Muhammad, and there is some doubt that Kardash can do that, but he is a former military officer from Saddam Hussein's Iraqi army. He also does have some religious credentials. He was known as the professor, and it looks like he will probably be the successor. For how long, we don't know. What kind of support will he get from ISIS as a whole? We're not sure. But at least we can expect that there will be a next generation of leadership. What that will mean for the future of ISIS as a whole, we can't be sure yet.
Former South Dakota legislator Dan Ahlers has announced his candidacy for the U.S. Senate. His platform focuses on the economy, education, and healthcare. Ahlers joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh to talk about his vision and why he believes he's a better fit than Senator Mike Rounds.
So let's start with why now. Why did you decide to throw your hat in the ring at this particular time?
I think a lot of it comes with the hyper-partisanship that I see in politics. I am certainly someone who has believed in public service and has participated in a variety of capacities as a community advocate, president of several different community organizations, nonprofits, and certainly as a state legislator. And there's nothing's getting done. Somebody has to step up. Somebody has to be that positive role model and that example. And if you're thinking that, then you should probably be doing that. And that's one of the big reasons that I've entered this race, because I think I have a record of working well with others across party lines. And I believe that getting stuff done and addressing those real needs of people of South Dakota are very important.
All right. Why is U.S. Senator Mike Rounds vulnerable? There's a challenge from his own party. You've thrown your hat in the ring. So clearly people feel like it's not a foregone conclusion that South Dakotans want him in Washington and they might be ready for a change. Where do you think the vulnerabilities lie there?
Well, I think some of the vulnerabilities lie in the partisanship that he's engaged in. It's always the Democrats' fault. They're always using the extremes of the Democrat Party to paint a broad brush over the Democrats as a whole. And certainly that's not true. You know, he talks about being a fiscal conservative. And I served in the legislature when he was governor. When he left office, he left our state with a $127 million budget deficit and two financial scandals that cost taxpayers of South Dakota millions of dollars and the tragic loss of life. He raised fees on small business owners like dairy farmers, all to balance the state budget. So when he says he balanced the state budget, he doesn't talk about how it was done. You know, I voted against those fee increases. I voted against some of his budgets as a state legislator. I also brought two different tax reductions as a state legislator because we made a promise to the people of South Dakota to invest that money wisely. And we had the Blue Ribbon Task Force had passed that half percent increase for education. We won the Wayfair versus South Dakota case. We were supposed to get rid of that tax. That tax is still out there. I brought a proposal to do that when I was in the legislature. And I think that we have to be the safeguards of the taxpayer money out there. We have to invest it wisely. And when that's not being done, then we need to do something about it.
The ag economy in particular is a difficult one right now with the international trade problems that we've had, tariffs, problems with getting the USMCA even up for a vote in Congress. Tell us a little bit about, from your platform perspective, what are some of the things from an economic perspective that you're focusing on?
Well, certainly the USMCA needs to be brought up for a vote. I'm not sure what the delay is. If it's partisan politics, that's unacceptable. We need to get that out there. That would certainly help our dairy and poultry farmers in South Dakota. I also think that, people talk about the trade war going on. I certainly agree with the president that we need better trade policy and we need to have better trade agreements. I part ways with him on how we went about it. You don't pick a fight with your biggest trade partner without having a backup plan. The recent deal he had with Japan is a great example. Had he done some of those things ahead of time, we could have minimized the impact on our farmers. I liken it to a job that you don't like. We all have had a boss or a job that we were just miserable at. We didn't like it. We always dream in our heads of telling them to take this job and shove it. I mean, it's so popular, they made a song about it. But that's not what we do. I mean, we all understand we have responsibilities, families, bills. There are things that we have to do and we have to work to take care of. So what do we really do? Well, the dream is nice. We go out and we find another job and we give our 2-week notice. And if you'd applied that same principle to our trade agreements and how we work trade, our farmers wouldn't be suffering right now and they wouldn't be taking government handouts. And I know our farmers don't want government handouts.
I want to circle back to the USMCA because in an interview on this program with U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson, he blamed the Democrats, particularly Nancy Pelosi, for not bringing USMCA up for a vote in the House. So as a Democrat going in to Congress, you're not afraid to stand against the party leadership there in Washington. Talk a little bit about what's happening in Washington amongst the Democratic Party and how you sort of distinguish yourself from some of that messaging to be a true representative for South Dakotans.
Well, I don't know who's to blame for it not getting up for a vote, but certainly if it is Democratic leadership, I would be someone who is vocal about that, and I would stand up to my party leadership. I have a record of doing that. Even though I've been, a leader on the Appropriations Committee, we've had times where I've disagreed with my own party leadership, and I even made the paper for voting down a bill in committee that belonged to our minority leader. Certainly not what you want. You hope that you can talk people down and help them make better decisions and find ways to work together. But I do what's right for the people I represent.
Let's talk a little bit about education. What are some of your thoughts on what needs to be addressed in Washington regarding education today?
Well, certainly, I think we need to involve our educators more in this process. We pass a lot of legislation with regards to education, a lot of requirements, and I've spent a lot of time in the schools. As I mentioned before, I do a little subbing, and teachers are frustrated. They have a difficult job. Financially, they're not supported very well. We need to do more to enable them to do their job, which means we have to be listening to those educators. Our school systems can do more for workforce development. You know, one of the biggest challenges in our economy is adapting to this new industrial age of fast-paced change in technology. And I think that we can do more getting kids out there in real work and life situations. I think they learn better in those situations, and we can do more there. I think special education funding needs to be looked at again. IDEA, the state is only receiving 40% of the federal funding it was promised when this was passed nearly 40 years ago. We need to do better. That's a high expense for our schools. A lot of times they're footing the bill out ahead, way ahead, and then waiting for that money to come in, and that's just not acceptable. I think from the post-secondary side, we need to do a little more with making college more affordable. South Dakota is 42nd in the nation. Our students are coming out of school with an average of $32,000 of debt, and nearly three-quarters of our students are coming out with that kind of debt. That happened to me. I graduated with $34,000 worth of college debt, and I worked full-time going to college. It's not cheap, and what that does, you know, people say, well, people need to pay their way, but when you come out with that amount of debt, it limits your options. It limits the possibilities when you're trying to start a career and you're trying to be someone who's productive in society. And we can do better. We can do more with needs-based scholarships. We can do more with finding creative ways to drive the costs of education down.
And that college-based debt, that really oppressive debt. You're an entrepreneur. You're in business. That really limits innovation as well, because if you have all that debt, you can't take a chance on opening a new business at all.
Certainly, you know, if you have these business and marketing graduates coming out, people in the IT world that have, you know, this entrepreneurial spirit and they want to get something started. I've been through that. I started my first business at 24. Having that college debt out there, that doesn't help. It makes it extremely difficult. I was turned down several times and told that my business model wouldn't work, that it would fail. You know, the college debt sitting out there, it was risky. I fought through it and probably took a loan that I shouldn't have because it had almost 13% interest rate, but I succeeded when the odds were stacked against me, but I don't recommend it. It's not the preferable way of doing things, and I don't know that you always get the success story that I had with being in business for 20 years. I think you get people that don't succeed, and you discourage that type of innovation, and it doesn't turn out the way it always that it did for me.
I want to talk about education and healthcare, and then put it in context of what we see with Democrats running for the presidency in the debates and stuff. There's such a wide variety of how those voices see solving some of those problems. And in your own campaign here in South Dakota, when you announced Dan Lederman from the South Dakota Republican Party, used the word socialist agenda, which we're hearing a lot as, you know, sort of being thrown around the word socialism. So tell me from, and we'll switch to healthcare a little bit, where do you stand on a continuum of how to solve some of those problems with the cost of healthcare in America and the way coverage is challenging so many South Dakotans?
Well, you know, the problem with labels is you're speaking in generalities, and more often than not, I find that that's not true. I spend a lot of time working with what most people would consider very conservative colleagues in the state legislature. We find ways to get things done. We find the things that we have in common. Those are the things that we work on and focus on. I really, you know, when you see and hear comments like we had from Mr. Lederman, it disappoints me. I spent time working with him in the legislature, and certainly that wasn't his attitude then. I enjoyed working with him, and he said the same of me. So seeing those comments is a little disheartening. But I think when it comes to myself, my candidacy, the way I do things, if you look at my record, I am a fiscal conservative. I think that you find you invest where you need to spend the money, but you also find ways to make plans run more efficiently. I was on a lean subcommittee as part of appropriations, and the whole philosophy is working with the business or committee or department to find better ways of doing things, following a process and seeing where the you know, things fall apart, where you have a problem, where you have a piece of paper that's hitting 26 different desks. Does it really need to hit 26 different desks for that person to get to the title of their vehicle? And what you find when you do those types of processes is you get a buy-in from the people that are working underneath you or working for a department, and you find better ways of doing things, more efficient ways of doing things. We were able to do that at the state level and continue to do that at the state level, and I believe we can take those same principles and apply them to anything at the federal level, whether it be healthcare or education or trade policies. Any of that stuff, we can take these principles. And it's really a simple small business principle, too. I mean, I've done it as a business owner where I've got to find a way to make things work better in order to accommodate higher wages for my employees, the increase of utilities or rent. I mean, you when you own a small business in a small community, there's only so many dollars to go around, so you have to squeeze as much as you can out of that to make it work the best way possible.
And in that same vein, things on the state level that you have been interested in your record on veterans health care or veterans issues that you intend to take to Washington as well?
Well, certainly in Pierre, I worked towards getting the Veterans Cemetery out here and helping get the funding for that here just north of Sioux Falls. I also passed a resolution asking Congress to address issues at our veterans' home at Hot Springs. When veterans retire and they decide to move in to the VA home out in Hot Springs, they get a per diem. If they get to what they call two daily activity points, which is called assisted living, they have to leave. They have to leave the VA home, and they can't come back till their nursing home care. We should be able to provide a continuum of care for our veterans once they enter that VA home. And I think that we need to get a designation and a per diem for that assisted living category.
They don't have any assisted living there? I thought they did have assisted living care at the vet's home in Hot Springs.
No. This was brought up when we were out there, and it piqued my curiosity. It's what ultimately led to me writing that and passing that resolution in the state legislature. And I'm sure what happened is over time, as assisted living became a category, the laws just weren't adjusted to it, and the per diem wasn't adjusted to accommodate that. But that's a real need, and I think that we should be able to provide that. As I knocked on doors and I campaigned in District 25 over the years, the number of veterans that have not been able to get VA services or had delayed services. My grandfather served in World War II in Korea. My brother currently serves and will probably be retiring here in a year. These men and women have served our country, and regardless of their disability, their situation, they should not be denied those services. They should, every single veteran in South Dakota, in this country, should be able to get VA services without question. So we need to do a better job of streamlining that process and those veterans, getting those veterans the services that they deserve.
Dan Ahlers, candidate for U.S. Senate, running as a Democrat against U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. Being on the road, shaking hands, knocking on doors, that energize you? How do you enjoy the process itself of campaigning?
I would label myself a retail politician. I'm someone who likes to get out there, meet, and talk to people. So certainly I'm doing at least two events a week. I enjoy getting out, talking to people, listening. You know, one of the things that I did as a state legislator when I brought legislation is most of what I brought came from the conversations that I had with people at forums, on the street, knocking doors. And when that's the stuff that you bring to Pierre and I hope to bring to Washington, then you know you're really doing something, that you're addressing real issues for the people that you represent.
South Dakota's Water Management Board is holding hearings on the Keystone XL pipeline during the week when a Keystone oil spill in North Dakota is making national news. Reports say 383,000 gallons of oil spilled before containment, contaminating wetlands but not drinking water. State Senator Troy Heinert told the board on Thursday, October 31st, that he's concerned about potential damage to South Dakota's agriculture and tourism industries if water is polluted. Troy Heinert is a member of the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. He's also a rancher and enrolled member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. He says the Department of Environment and Natural Resources doesn't have enough employees who can go out into the field to inspect sites where problems have been reported. Heinert says DENR hasn't seen an increase in full-time employee positions in 14 years.
I would hope that we get more dedicated professionals like we have who are out there representing the people of South Dakota and the state of South Dakota, and looking at these applications and or lines that are already built with objective eyes.
Under cross-examination, TC Energy attorney William Taylor asks Heinert if he has faith in the Water Management Board's judicial process, and Heinert responds,
they might even have a more intimate knowledge of this process than even we do as a legislature.
Sure. And
hopefully without the politics.
Exactly, without the politics.
Heinert says he has constituents in his district who support the pipeline and others who don't. He says he listens to all, but as a rancher, he knows the importance of clean water.
Without water, you don't have livestock. You don't have crops.
He says the Miniwichoni Water Project in particular has opened up grazing range for him and for his ranching constituents.
It has changed their life and changed how they can operate.
Heinert says he's concerned that the oil pipeline crosses over the water pipeline and a spill could make that water unusable. The Water Management Board has added four more days in December for hearings in Pierre. Because opponent witnesses have been allowed to cut in line because they're not available later, TC Energy still has not completed its case in chief. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
Why is America losing its ranches? That was the title of Bill Bullard's presentation to the South Dakota Stock Growers Association at their 128th annual convention and trade show in Rapid City. Bullard, a former cattle rancher in Perkins County, is the CEO of RCAF USA, an organization that represents the U.S. cattle industry in trade, marketing, and private property rights issues to ensure the continued profitability and viability of independent producers.
Tell us a little bit about the mood at the convention and trade show right now. As you know, what are you sort of picking up from other operators?
The mood is concern and seriousness. These producers realize that the beef industry is extremely profitable and that we've had strong beef demand, strong exports of our product, and consumers continue to pay near record prices for beef. And yet cattle producers are receiving depressed prices such that they received 9 years ago. So they are not enjoying the benefits of the good market conditions that are allowing others in the beef supply chain to earn windfall profits.
And this is important because it could be permanent in some, I mean, this isn't just a blip that's happening. What are the forces that are sort of working toward depressing those prices? Elaborate on that, if you will.
Well, the cattle industry is viewed as the last frontier. It's the single largest segment of American agriculture, vitally important to rural communities all across America. And it's the last industry to be controlled by the meatpacking industry from birth to plate. They had controlled and captured the poultry industry back in the 70s. They captured and controlled the hog industry in the 90s. We wiped out 75% of all the hog farmers just in the course of about 20 years, beginning in 1990. And now the meatpackers have their sights set on the cattle industry, and they find it's a lot easier to manage just a few producers than it is to manage the disaggregated group of hundreds of thousands of producers. So we have seen our numbers shrink at an alarming rate. In the last 40 years, we've lost over 500,000 cattle producers. We've seen our cow herd shrink at an alarming rate. In the past, just since the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1994, we've reduced our cow numbers by 3 million head. And we're seeing an alarming decline in the number of the cattle feedlots. And those are the purchasers of the calves that the most South Dakota farmers and ranchers will sell in the fall. We now have 75% fewer potential buyers for those calves than we had just 23 years ago. And so this did not happen overnight. We're on a trajectory of continuing to shrink our industry, of continuing to reduce the profitability for independent cattle producers, and we must turn this around.
And it's not based on lack of demand. The consumers are
absolutely
still buying
not.
Beef. The consumers are still paying for beef. They still want the best possible steak on their plate. How do you turn it around? Let's start there.
Well, we start with what are the problems. The problems are, number one, our marketplace is broken and it's functioning in a dysfunctional manner. Number two, cattle producers are deprived the ability to distinguish their superior product even in their own domestic marketplace. So they can't differentiate their product from the growing tide of imported beef and cattle that is both cheaper and undifferentiated when it gets to America. And then we have the problem of both the government and transnational corporations that are working together to actually capture control of the supply chain away from independent producers. And then we have the problem of producers are being compelled to actually finance those first three negative forces that are destroying our industry. So to reverse that, we filed, number one, for broken markets. We filed a historic antitrust lawsuit alleging that the big four beef packers had conspired to artificially reduce prices paid to producers while at the same time inflating the profits and margins that they receive. With respect to the inability to compete in our own marketplace, we are pushing for the full restoration of mandatory country of origin labeling. It must be mandatory because cattle producers in South Dakota, when they sell their calves in the fall, they have to have an assurance that the beef from those animals will ultimately be labeled as a superior product, as a product that was born, raised, and harvested right here in America.
Go ahead and explain to consumers, people who are not in the cattle industry, why it's a superior product. Because it's not just because we like South Dakota or we like, you know, we're patriotic. There's things that are going into those operations that are making it different than something you can find somewhere else. Explain why it's a superior product.
Right. Well, as a sophisticated nation, the United States has invested millions upon millions in order to eradicate and control pernicious diseases within our industry. And we have established some of the most stringent health and safety standards known throughout the world. And so our producers produce beef under those superior conditions, and therefore the safety and quality of their product is better than anywhere else. One good example of that, for example, would be that U.S. cattle producers have to get a veterinary certification if they're to feed antibiotics to cattle. That only applies to U.S. cattle producers. It does not apply to cattle producers in Canada, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, or any one of the 20 countries that we import beef from. So we know we produced under the most stringent production standards. Our quality is second to none, and so it is a superior product. And we can defend that based on the facts, knowing that other countries are cutting corners.
And so how is stuff, if you go into the grocery store today, how is it labeled? You know, if it says it's USA beef, what does that mean today?
Well, it means one of two things, that the animal from which the beef was derived had been slaughtered in a U.S. slaughtering plant. In other words, could have been delivered here in a sealed truck from Canada, unloaded at the packer gate, and then slaughtered. The resulting meat could be labeled as product of USA. Or it could be an imported product brought into the United States in a package and then brought to a U.S. processing plant where the package is unwrapped, and then they throw the foreign label in the garbage, and then they rewrap the package and put a USA label on. This problem arose beginning in 2015 when Congress repealed mandatory country of origin labeling for beef. So the solution is to restore mandatory country of origin labeling for beef. And consumers will recognize that many other products continue to be subject to that law. You have fruits and vegetables and peanuts and fish and seafood and chicken and lamb. Chicken and lamb will all be labeled as a product, you know, born in the United States, raised and slaughtered in the United States, or born in Canada, raised and slaughtered in the United States. So consumers have a choice whether to support foreign producers of cattle or to support the American cattle producer right here in the United States of America that is operating under those more stringent production standards and producing that highest quality beef.
So our current governor, Kristi Noem, was Congresswoman Kristi Noem, and I remember interviewing her about country of origin labeling. It was very important to her at the time. What are we hearing from South Dakota's congressional delegates about their thoughts on country of label origin on COOL today?
Well, very recently, we saw a news release, in fact, yesterday from both Senator Rounds and Senator Thune, and they intend to introduce legislation to establish a voluntary standard that requires the USA label to be reserved for beef that is born, raised, and slaughtered in the United States. Unfortunately, that's only a symptom of the problem. It does not go far enough to give U.S. cattle producers assurances that when they sell their animal, the resulting beef will ultimately be labeled in the marketplace. Our industry desperately needs the full restoration of mandatory country of origin labeling so consumers can choose to support the U.S. farmers and ranchers or some foreign farmers and ranchers. Anything less falls well short of what our industry needs. And currently in this time of crisis with depressed prices, we cannot be chasing these sticks that the Congress wants to throw at us. So we are not at all supportive of that effort.
Let's talk about trade a little bit. As you mentioned, NAFTA, now we're looking at the USMCA agreement. Is it markedly better, USMCA, for cattle producers? Is it the same? Is it worse? What are your thoughts on USMCA?
The answer is no change whatsoever. So the North American Free Trade Agreement that contributed to the 25% decline in the number of ranches, that contributed to decline in our number of cattle, that contributed to decline of our feedlot operations, that will be memorialized under the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. Unfortunately, the negotiators, our trade ambassador, was influenced by the extremely powerful meatpacking lobby that convinced them to make no changes whatsoever in the trade of cattle and beef. However, he did make changes for other sectors of the economy, like the auto and truck industry. He requires a higher percentage of components to be included in the supply chain in order for the product to receive duty-free treatment. He also recognized the importance of strengthening our U.S. supply chains in the textile industry, promoting more U.S.-produced yarn and fabric and thread for those production. But for the cattle industry, he did absolutely nothing. So we're asking Congress to vote no on the extension of NAFTA, which is now the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, unless they at least fully restore country of origin labeling for beef, and then U.S. producers will be able to compete in their own marketplace against this growing tide of imports from both Canada and Mexico.
Recently, there was a fire at a Kansas packing plant, and there was outrage about some of the fallout from that. Can you explain that to listeners and tie it into this litigation about sort of slaughter reductions and how the packing industry, as you see it, is, making decisions that negatively impact farmers and producers?
Sure. Well, the cattle industry is among, if not the most, highly concentrated marketing structure in any segment of our U.S. economy. We have four major meat packers that control 85% of the fed cattle market in our industry. And so on August 9th, one of the large packers had a fire at their plant, and that plant happened to produce about 5% of the cattle. And so that reduced demand for cattle by 5%, and there was a precipitous fall in cattle prices. And it was that incident that I think was the straw that broke the camel's back, that producers who have seen this precipitous fall in their prices for no explainable reason before, when it occurred recently in August, after prices had already been depressed for some time, it really triggered the sense of urgency on the part of producers. And so now even the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture stepped forward and said he will investigate as to whether or not there were any anti-competitive practices on the part of the packers after this event, because after the event, we still saw near-record prices for retail beef, wholesale beef prices climbed, and yet the cattle prices paid to the U.S. farmers and ranchers remained seriously depressed. So this is a symptom of the broken markets that we have and a clear demonstration that the markets are not functioning properly. We have market failure in the industry that needs to be addressed, and we have chosen to address it through our antitrust lawsuit.
You mentioned the cattle industry is the last frontier. What happens if things shift similar to the way things did with hogs or chickens? What does it look like in the future if nothing changes from the path we're on right now?
Well, you're going to drive a lot further on South Dakota roads without seeing any ranch headquarters or farmhouses. What you will see is a hollowing out of rural areas. You will see a decline in the rural economies. You will see Main Street businesses start to get boarded up. It is absolutely the worst possible outcome because, again, the cattle industry is the largest segment of American agriculture. We have cattle production in every state of the union, and it is vitally important as an economic cornerstone for many, many rural communities. And that is all at risk as we talk today.
State Senator Gary Kamak joined us to talk about the upcoming South Dakota legislative session and how agriculture and the future of farming may be included in the overall dialogue. Kamak chairs the Ag Land Tax Task Force.
Let's start with the fact that the legislative session is a few months out, but boy, it's coming up. It's coming up kind of quickly here.
Yeah, 2 months from now is tomorrow, it seems like.
And you never really stop, really. I mean, for a lot of us, these are issues that are throughout the year. What are some of the things that you see being ag-related coming up in this next session? Give us some high points, and then we'll dig into them.
Well, it's certainly no secret that we're going to be taking a hard look at the industrial hemp production in the state of South Dakota. That'll be one of the issues. We're going to also be taking a look at the property tax issues. We went to a productivity model in 2010, and that productivity model bases the property tax on the land's ability to produce, and the formula includes determining the soil type and the climate and what the ability of that land to produce. But anytime you deal with anything that complex, you're going to have ongoing issues and some things that we can tweak a little bit here and there to just make the whole process more equitable for everyone across the state. So that's what we're in the process of doing right now. We met just recently, And we got an update from the Department of Revenue, and we've got a lot of other facts and figures. And so then we're going to meet again on November 15th in Pier. And at that time, we're going to consider some different ideas about some things we can do to make the system a little more equitable for everyone across the state.
And it is fairly complex for people to understand, but the results and the differences for individual operators can be stark. They've had a tough year with everything from tariffs to flooding. Tell us a little bit about when you make a tweak or you make an adjustment, what kind of difference can it make for an individual South Dakota family?
Yeah, it can be it can be from fairly minor to fairly significant, and the goal is in any time you deal with taxation legislation or rules, the goal is to be equitable to everyone. And so, as a percentage of the net profit that any one farmer takes or rancher takes off of the land, we don't want that taxation number to be such a high percentage of the ability of that land to produce that it creates a undue burden on that individual. And so any time that you make an adjustment in one place, we've got the bills to pay, and it's going to take so much money to pay them, and so the money has to come from somewhere. So it's a really complex issue, and it takes a lot of study and a lot of facts and figures and numbers to be able to make those even minor changes and to assure folks that it's not going to be catastrophic to someone else in the system.
And with the state revenue sort of decreasing, we've seen some of those reports also being of concern from you know, as you said, how those bills are getting paid. There's a lot to balance in there.
Absolutely. And we've got a situation where, especially on the sales tax side of things, the sales tax revenues have held better than I thought they might. But we've got a farm and ranch supply store as well as a cattle ranch here in Union Center, and I know for a fact that on the livestock side of things, and that's we live and die with the cow market out here, and it certainly has declined over the last several years, and now this year, in my estimation, the price that we received for the calves have gone below the cost of production. So at very best, you're treading water in it, and at worst, you're losing some money, and it's getting to a critical spot right now. So I don't look for any kind of a spike of sales tax at the end of the year, and it doesn't make any difference if you're in the livestock business or in the small grains business. Traditionally, those producers, if they've had a good year, they'll certainly take a good hard look at making some larger purchases and adjusting some expenses to take advantage of that against income tax and things like that. And I do not see that happening either on the crop, the area of the state where there's mostly crops, or the area of the state where there's mostly livestock. It just the profits aren't there to even think about doing that sort of a purchase. Mm.
So last week we had a conversation with some cattle ranchers talking about country of origin labeling and how much the lack of it has really affected cattle prices and their operations and what they invest in the future. Is that one of the main drivers for those prices in decline and the challenges? Are there other things that are facing ranchers? And I guess I'm asking as a rancher,
no,
there, not just a lawmaker, but yeah.
Exactly. There's no doubt that our cattle market is driven by exports. And I always say never underestimate the ability of the American farmer or rancher to overproduce. And so we are just really good at what we do, and we have the privilege in the United States of being very food secure, and in fact to the point where we need to have the exports to be able to keep the markets to a place where it can be profitable for those producers. So exports are just a big part of profitability in the
in South Dakota and the United States.
All right, let's talk about industrial hemp production. The USDA has released draft rules for hemp manufacturing. There's a 60-day public comment period. How is this all intersecting with the upcoming legislative session?
Well, with those rules out, that gives a lot more clarity to what needs to be done to stay within the rules and within the laws as it pertains to the production of industrial hemp. And last year, I supported the production of industrial hemp. And one of the reasons I wanted to see it happen last year is because the profitability of any crop is somewhat determined by the distance to the terminal market. In other words, the distance you have to haul the product to get it to where it's processed or further manufactured to a finished product. And we had a couple of companies that came forward and said if we can get this thing done, they were ready to go forward and put together some processing plants in the state of South Dakota so that we could have those terminal markets fairly close. So we'll see if those companies are still around and if we can get the legislation in place to get this accomplished. And right now, we're ending up to be a bit of an island. I think it's been legalized in, I believe, 47 states, and you probably know what the number is. But so it's not as if we're trying to reinvent the wheel, because the legalization of it in most agricultural states has already taken place. Hmm.
So one of the challenges here in South Dakota, of course, is Governor Kristi Noem, who's taken a national stand by writing a national column about why she's opposed to it. So the dynamic in South Dakota for the upcoming legislative session includes a conversation with the governor. How do you see that unfolding?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, her concerns are certainly well-founded. I think that there's been some advances in technology as far as being able to do some field tests on for the level of THC that's in a given product. So if law enforcement stops a truck that's loaded with industrial hemp, just by eye, it's real tough to tell the difference between that and the real thing. But I know that there's some companies that have really been working on coming up with some instruments where they can do the field test and come up with some answers, at least preliminary answers, so that you know if you're dealing with industrial hemp or marijuana.
Do you think that she can be convinced to sign legislation, or do you think you need to be prepared to override a veto from a procedure standpoint?
You know, I'm certainly hopeful that there'll be some things come about that gives her enough of a comfort level that we can come to some kind of a compromise and get the job done.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment segments podcast. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh Heyer, I'm Chris Lawfrey. Thank you for listening.